Chapter 8, The Problem of Systemic Climate Distortion. Understanding the Likely Climate Impacts of Rising CO2 Levels. Here's where we are. The purpose of this part of the book is to evaluate rising CO2 levels, the one and only side effect of continuing fossil fuel use that could hypothetically justify restricting fossil fuel use going forward, in their full context from a human flourishing perspective. This includes factoring in three key variables. The first variable is the widely denied overall benefits of fossil fuels to human flourishing. As we saw in part two, the ultra-cost-effective energy we get from fossil fuels is fundamental to the unnatural, amazing livability of our world, and not only irreplaceable in the coming decades by alternatives, but needed in growing quantities to make the world more livable for more people. This means that any negative climate impacts caused by fossil fuels would need to be truly catastrophic to justify any restriction of fossil fuel use, and truly apocalyptic to justify the guaranteed apocalypse of rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use. The second variable is the widely denied benefits of the fossil-fueled climate mastery that will come with rising CO2 levels, which can potentially neutralize and overwhelm any negative climate impacts. In the previous chapter, we saw that these benefits are so enormous that no climate impacts resembling those of the last 170 years, which have themselves featured rising CO2 levels, could cause an increasingly empowered world serious problems. For future CO2 levels to be catastrophic, let alone apocalyptic, would require a completely different kind of climate impact from future CO2 level rises, such as a rapid, accelerating, and unstoppable rise in temperatures, storms with multiple times the power of history's worst storms, or sea level rises of feet per decade. Which brings us to the third variable and the subject of this chapter and the next, the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels understood from a human flourishing perspective, including negative, neutral, and positive impacts. We want to understand these impacts, including, above all, whether any of them rise to the completely unprecedented level that would make us consider restricting the use of fossil fuels and therefore doing guaranteed damage to the livability of our world. Note, as I mentioned in the previous chapter, throughout this book I am referring to rising CO2 levels as a catch-all for all of fossil fuel side effects related to greenhouse gases that have a warming impact on the atmosphere. The reason is that CO2 is overwhelmingly the most significant greenhouse gas emitted by fossil fuels. For example, it lasts far longer in the atmosphere than methane does and is emitted in so much greater quantities than methane that it is universally acknowledged to have a much greater warming impact. Understanding the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels means answering the question, what will be the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system from a human flourishing perspective? To communicate the full meaning of this question, let me ask it in a more elaborate form. As CO2 in the atmosphere rises to different levels due to human CO2 emissions, what impacts are likely to occur on 1. Temperatures around the world, 2. Precipitation patterns around the world, and 3. Sea levels around the world? And how will those changes impact derivative climate-related phenomena, such as drought, affected by temperatures and precipitation patterns, wildfire conditions, affected by temperatures and precipitation patterns, and flooding, affected by sea levels and precipitation patterns? Additionally, how will rising CO2 levels impact plant life and oceans, for example, ocean acidification? These are not strictly climate impacts, but they are potentially significant environmental impacts related to rising CO2 levels. For efficiency, I am including them when I use the summary term climate impacts. Finally, are there any other significant environmental impacts of rising CO2 levels? such as the potential for mass species extinctions that we hear about? All of the preceding I include under the question, what will be the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system from a human flourishing perspective? It's important to emphasize the likely in this question, which I have included because it is not reasonable given current understanding of climate to expect certainty in predictions. With some predictive questions, certainty is possible, namely those questions where experts fully understand and can quantify the crucial cause and effect relationships involved. For example, if rocket scientists are all given a certain set of parameters under which a rocket launches from Earth, they will all come up with the same prediction of its basic trajectory. This is because the physics of rocket trajectories are well known, confirmed by real-world experiment after real-world experiment. Ideally, the state of climate science and climate prediction would be such that we could get certainty, based on precisely understood mechanisms of cause and effect, about what specific climate impacts will occur at what points on the trajectory of CO2 level rises. Unfortunately for climate prediction, this is not the case today. The chief reason is that the global climate system is, to put it mildly, highly complex, incomparably more complex than a rocket launch. The climate conditions in any given area, at any moment and over time, are impacted by many, many variables that are not fully understood and/or quantifiable, including the complex interactions of clouds with the light from the sun and infrared radiation from the Earth's surface, the large energy buffers that the oceans provide, the sun's particle wind, the Earth's wobble, changes in water vapor, ozone levels, albedo, the reflectivity of the Earth's surface, cosmic rays, the state of plant life, ocean currents, the activity of volcanoes, and of course, the levels of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. These mechanisms and how they interrelate are simply not well enough understood at this stage of knowledge to make climate predictions with certainty. Another obstacle to a precise understanding of how CO2 impacts climate is the relatively low quality of data that scientists have to work with. If climate scientists knew with precision what temperature and precipitation have been in every location going back hundreds of millions of years, along with what exactly the states of all the variables impacting climate, including CO2, have been, they would be in a strong position to understand and quantify how exactly CO2 impacts climate. But our historical data about temperatures and precipitation patterns, among other things, is quite limited. Take the question of the average temperature of the Earth. The two main ways of estimating this today are, one, attempting to take a representative sample of surface thermometers around the globe, and two, using satellites to measure a certain section of the atmosphere, the lower troposphere. But for even the last 100 years, let alone before that, there has been a very limited thermometer presence in much of the world. The U.S. has by far the best record. Comprehensive global temperature data from satellites exists only for the period since 1979. We have other ways of determining past temperatures, such as using tree rings, but these have nowhere near the precision of thermometers or satellites, and even thermometers and satellites have precision issues. The lack of quality historical climate data makes it difficult to understand with precision how the variable of CO2, or any other variable, has functioned in the past in relation to other variables. The difficulties of climate prediction do not mean that nothing of predictive significance is knowable. Far from it. There is much known about the physics of climate, including CO2, and it is possible to discern signal from noise, even with imperfect data. What the difficulties of climate prediction do mean is that we should look for likely, not certain, answers, and we should recognize that responsible climate predictors will acknowledge areas of ignorance and uncertainty. The final aspect of the question, what are the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system from a human flourishing perspective is the human flourishing perspective. We need to reject the anti-impact framework's approach of treating all climate impact as intrinsically negative because it violates the standard of eliminating human impact, and instead, using a human flourishing standard, be open to and look for not only negative impacts, but also positive and neutral ones. Now that I've explained the key question for understanding fossil fuels' climate impacts, what are the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system from a human flourishing perspective, let me turn to the first question we need to answer in order to answer it. Where do we get the necessary expert knowledge? How trustworthy or untrustworthy is the modern climate knowledge system? To the extent it is possible to predict the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels, such a prediction requires expert specialized knowledge that can be acquired only by subject matter experts with years of study. How do we get that knowledge? As I've discussed throughout this book, we are supposed to get such knowledge from our knowledge system, the set of institutions and people we rely on to research, synthesize, disseminate, and evaluate what is true. But as we have seen over and over, the mainstream knowledge system, especially its disseminators and evaluators, is fundamentally distorted by the anti-impact framework, which causes it to consistently ignore fossil fuels' fundamental benefits to human flourishing and to catastrophize fossil fuels' thus far masterable side effects. Its catastrophizing includes, as we saw in Chapter 2 and Chapter 4, wildly and negatively distorting the various environmental side effects of fossil fuels, including by elevating the minority of specialists with the most extreme negative views to the status of designated experts. And in the previous chapter, we saw pervasive climate mastery denial that makes suspect all catastrophe predictions we hear from our knowledge system. Everything we've learned about the nature and track record of the mainstream knowledge system should lead us to be at minimum skeptical of what any given disseminator, such as the New York Times, says about the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. On the other hand, there seem to be other factors that make at least significant portions of our knowledge system trustworthy about the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. One is that the modern climate knowledge system, in particular, has many of the trappings of a properly functioning knowledge system. The modern climate knowledge system draws upon research institutions around the world that are supposedly engaging in unbiased climate research. To synthesize that research, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, reviews the state of climate research every 6 or 7 years or so and synthesizes the findings, including the probability of various outcomes. In the U.S., we also have the National Climate Assessment, which synthesizes the findings that are most relevant to the U.S. These assessment organizations issue detailed reports as well as summaries, such as the IPCC Summary for Policymakers. Thus, it's reasonable to expect that even if the New York Times will not properly disseminate the best knowledge on the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels, other forms of dissemination, such as the IPCC Summary for Policymakers and the public claims of other scientific organizations, will. And given that virtually every science-related institution we come into contact with says that the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels are extremely negative, it's reasonable to expect that this general narrative is very likely to be true, even if we grant that it is also likely to often be overstated. A final reason to have basic confidence in much of our climate knowledge system and what we hear from it is the seeming lack of widespread dissension by researchers. If our knowledge system were distorting the science of CO2's climate impacts in the same way it has done so in the past with CO2 and other side effects of fossil fuels, wouldn't many researchers in the field speak up and protest? And wouldn't we know about them? But as reasonable as it is to expect our climate knowledge system to be good overall and accurate on questions of science this is demonstrably not the case. Just as the anti-impact framework caused our knowledge system's track record of catastrophizing, including wildly negative distortions of the relevant science, so it is demonstrably distorting science today through the climate knowledge system. In the next sections, I will document massive system-wide distortions in the climate knowledge system's evaluation of CO2's climate impacts, including distortions of research, of synthesis, and of dissemination. These distortions fall into two major categories: the CO2 benefit denial distortion and the deliberate overstatement distortion. The CO2 benefit denial distortion. In Chapter 7, we saw over and over how our knowledge system engages in climate mastery denial, denying that empowered human beings can produce highly effective climate protections that can overcome all kinds of climate dangers. This is one example of a broader phenomenon, the benefit denial distortion I documented in Chapters 1, 2, and 4, denying the benefits of something and focusing only on its negative side effects, which we have seen our knowledge system and designated experts do with all the benefits of fossil fuels. The benefit denial distortion applies not only to the denied benefits of fossil fuels, including climate mastery benefits, but also to the widely denied beneficial impacts of rising CO2 levels themselves. CO2 is both a warming gas and a fertilizing gas. 1 minute of common sense thinking about the effects of rising levels of such a gas should lead to the expectation that it will have at least some significant positive impacts, namely, some beneficial warming in dangerously cold conditions and some beneficial plant growth, including crop growth, from an atmosphere with more plant food. And yet, our knowledge system fails to seriously consider these benefits of CO2. I don't merely mean that knowledge dissemination institutions like the New York Times or the Washington Post fail to. I mean that the entire system, from research funding to synthesis by the IPCC to dissemination by the New York Times, fails to. The most egregious instance of systemic CO2 benefit denial is with regard to the well-established fertilizer effect. It has been well established that when you increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, as happens when we burn fossil fuels, plants grow more because CO2 is plant food. As of 2021, we have CO2 levels at 420 parts per million, or 0.042% of the atmosphere. At 120 to 150 parts per million CO2, most plants die. Since ultimately all animals live on plants, carnivores live on herbivores, CO2 levels that low are apocalyptic, and today's CO2 levels are quite low from a plant preference perspective. All things being equal, more CO2 is better for plants, well into the thousands of parts per million. Thousands of experiments in controlled conditions, where everything is held constant except CO2, have convincingly demonstrated that more CO2 means more plant growth. Indeed, greenhouse growers, who pay money to triple the amount of CO2 in the air to improve food output, run such experiments every day. Scientists Sherwood Idso and Craig Idso have documented increases in crop yield when crucial crops were exposed to 300 parts per million more CO2 than is in the atmosphere. The fertilizer effect has been shown not only in controlled experiments, but also in very clear global greening as CO2 levels have risen. In the last two decades alone, the world has added additional green areas equivalent to the size of all the Amazon's rainforests. Even if the benefits of global greening from rising CO2 levels are outweighed by negatives, they have clearly still had massive positive impacts, including likely trillions of dollars worth of crop growth benefits. Those positive impacts certainly deserve extensive study and dissemination. And yet these extremely positive plant growth effects of CO2 are systemically denied by our knowledge system, including at the root of our knowledge system, decisions about research. The legendary late physicist Freeman Dyson tells a story about how the U.S. government from the beginning of its research on CO2 has been disinterested in the plant impacts of CO2. In the year 1978, United States Department of Energy drew up a comprehensive plan for carbon dioxide effects research and assessment, which fixed the agenda of official discussions of carbon dioxide for the next 37 years. I wrote in a memorandum protesting against the plan. The direct effects of carbon dioxide increase on plant growth and interspecific competition receive little attention. The plan is drawn up as if climatic change were the only serious effect of carbon dioxide on human activities. In a comparison of the non-climatic with the climatic effects of carbon dioxide, the non-climatic effects may be 1. More certain, 2. More immediate, 3. Easier to observe, and 4. Potentially at least as serious. Our research plan should address these issues directly, not as a mere sideline to climatic studies. My protest received no attention, and the comprehensive plan prevailed. As a result, the public perception of carbon dioxide has been dominated by the computer climate model experts who designed the plan. Dyson's experience is a microcosm of a broader phenomenon. Funding is almost exclusively given to research that will show negative, preferably extremely negative, impacts of CO2. Most scientific research today is funded by governments. To justify this research, the officials running the government must believe that the research has value to voters or to their own agendas. And the values of voters and elected officials are heavily influenced by the anti-impact framework, which leads them to be morally uncomfortable with climate impact and to expect disaster. Historically, government officials have found value in researching CO2 with the expectation that it would be a crisis that would require massive government intervention to save the planet. They have found little value in researching, let alone publicizing, positive impacts of CO2. This is even more so the case today, given a massive environmental activist and green energy lobby whose subsidized and mandated existence depends on CO2 having catastrophic climate impacts. Thus, there is a tendency to fund negative research about the impacts of CO2 and not to fund positive or neutral research. The negatively distorted funding of research in the mainstream knowledge system leads to benefit denial, as well as overstatement of negatives, which I'll discuss in the next section, even if everyone funded is 100% honest, because there is an absence of the honest people who would have studied the beneficial impacts of CO2 or had less negative views of the negatives of CO2. As we'll see in the next section, unfortunately, there is nothing resembling 100% honesty when it comes to the negatives of rising CO2 levels. And when research is distorted to ignore the benefits of fossil fuels, the rest of the knowledge system will follow, including synthesis, where the IPCC downplays the extremely significant potential of global greening for human flourishing, and dissemination, where the IPCC's latest summary for policymakers doesn't even mention the benefits of greening at all. The benefit denial distortion also exists with regard to the benefits of warming from rising CO2 levels. Historically, most human beings have wanted the world to be a warmer place. As we'll see in the next chapter, warming from CO2 is supposed to make the world warmer in A, places farther from the equator, that is, already cold places, B, in winters more than in summers, that is, when people usually want it to be warmer, and C, at night more than during the day, again, when people usually want it to be warmer. As we would expect warming to challenge us with more heat waves, we'd also expect it to benefit us with fewer cold-related problems. And remember that cold-related deaths today are many times more frequent than heat-related deaths. While today, under the influence of the anti-impact framework, we automatically regard human-induced warming as bad, this was not the attitude of scientists and other leading thinkers when the greenhouse effect was discovered. One of the discoverers of the effect, Svante Arrhenius, suggested that increased CO2 emissions would be an extremely beneficial byproduct of energy use because they would warm up the coldest areas of the world without warming very much near the equator. In 1896, he said, "By the influence of the increasing percentage of carbonic acid in the atmosphere, we may hope to enjoy ages with more equable and better climates, especially as regards the colder regions of the earth, ages when the earth will bring forth much more abundant crops than at present for the benefit of rapidly propagating mankind." A 1913 article expanded on Arrhenius's optimism. With the carbon dioxide increased from 2.5 to 3 times, the temperature of the whole world will be raised 3 to 9 degrees centigrade, and Greenland will have a good climate for farming. All the good soil of Canada will be in as temperate a climate as that now enjoyed by Missouri. Corn will be grown in the Peace River Valley. Oranges will be an orchard fruit in Arkansas and Virginia. The suburban residents of Chicago may literally sit under their own fig trees. Cotton will be a staple crop in Iowa. Bananas will fringe the shores of the Gulf. Siberia will become the greatest farming country in the world. Note that the amount of warming projected here, 3 to 9 degrees Celsius, is 3 to 9 times what has occurred so far, and there was still optimism. The point here is not that warming is necessarily overall good, as we must consider heat waves and especially rising sea levels, but there are massive amounts of good from warming that must be considered. Our climate knowledge system does not seriously consider them. The benefits of warming are a very rare subject for climate research, almost completely ignored by IPCC synthesis reports, and completely ignored by IPCC summaries for policymakers, as well as most other disseminators of climate knowledge. A climate knowledge system that denies the possibility of the massive plant growth and warming benefits of CO2 is a system that cannot be trusted. The root of our climate knowledge system's CO2 benefit denial is, of course, the anti-impact framework. On the anti-impact framework, which considers all significant human impact intrinsically immoral, on the goal of eliminating human impact, and inevitably self-destructive, on the delicate nurture assumption, CO2 emissions are invariably treated as intrinsically immoral and inevitably self-destructive, something from which there can be no real benefits. And, just as it always has, the anti-impact framework drives not just the systemic denial of positives, but the systemic overstatement of negatives. The deliberate overstatement distortion. If the anti-impact framework is driving our climate knowledge system to deny the beneficial climate impacts of fossil fuels, there is every reason to believe it is also driving the climate knowledge system to overstate the negative climate impacts of fossil fuels. In Chapter 2, we saw how designated climate experts in decades past not only denied climate mastery, but wildly overstated the warming and sea level rise impacts of rising CO2 levels. Is such overstatement happening today? In many situations, particularly those where the distortion toward overstatement is not known to the person distorting it, this is difficult to know. For example, how can we know if the anti-impact framework's delicate nurture assumption is causing a given climate modeler to unknowingly make a hotter model than they would if they were on the human flourishing framework's wild potential premise? But while unknowing overstatement is hard to detect, there is abundant documented deliberate overstatement throughout our climate knowledge system. In this section, I will document 4 forms of deliberate overstatement that dramatically and negatively distort our knowledge system's assessment of the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. 1. Punishment of climate catastrophe skepticism. 2. Equation of consensus on some climate impact with consensus on massively negative climate impact, the 97% fallacy. 3. Deliberately overstated report summaries. 4. Deliberate overstatement by designated experts for effect. Punishment of climate catastrophe skepticism. A driver of deliberate overstatement throughout the mainstream climate knowledge system from research to synthesis to dissemination, is the punishment of so-called climate change skeptics, who are actually skeptics of climate catastrophe. This punishment is inherent in the very composition of climate science today, which is overwhelmingly funded by governments participating in the IPCC, whose entire purpose is to document negative climate impacts of CO2 as a basis for significant global political action. What happens to those who think CO2's impacts are not significant enough to warrant restrictions on fossil fuels, let alone those who think they are net positive? Such people are regarded as derailing the crucial goal of making the public aware of climate catastrophe and driving action. And they are treated accordingly, being smeared publicly while privately being denied funding and promotions. Many eminent climate scientists have been publicly smeared as climate change skeptics, or even climate change deniers, even though they think the evidence shows that CO2 has a warming impact on climate. They just think the negativity of that impact is severely overstated, and/or the accompanying benefits of fossil fuels are severely understated. These climate change skeptics include Richard Lindzen, an award-winning climate scientist who, before he became controversial, was regarded as a brilliant mind in the field. Lindzen believes in a mild warming impact. In 2016, he said, "All scientists agree it's probably warmer now than it was at the end of the Little Ice Age. Almost all scientists agree that if you add CO2, you will have some warming. Maybe very little warming. But it is propaganda to translate that into, it is dangerous and we must reduce CO2. Judith Curry, another award-winning climate scientist, long based at Georgia Tech, who retired in 2017 from her tenured professorship, explaining, "A deciding factor was that I no longer know what to say to students and postdocs regarding how to navigate the craziness in the field of climate science. Research and other professional activities are professionally rewarded only if they are channeled in certain directions approved by a politicized academic establishment. Funding, ease of getting your papers published, getting hired in prestigious positions, appointments to prestigious committees and boards, professional recognition, etc." Patrick Michaels, another award-winning climate scientist who was a longtime research professor at the University of Virginia and past president of the American Association of State Climatologists. Michaels, who has written extensively about his view that fossil fuels cause lukewarming, slow, mild warming, has nonetheless been widely attacked as a denier. Publicly, we see punishment of questioning climate catastrophe in the form of smearing. But privately, as Curry's comment illustrates, it takes the form of lack of funding and promotion. In a climate knowledge system where debate is discouraged, voicing a non-catastrophist view, let alone doing research that leads to non-catastrophist conclusions, can lead to the loss of a job or research funding. This leads to a climate knowledge system that, by its nature, deliberately overstates what researchers actually think about the negative climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. Those who believe they are less negative or non-negative are driven out or have their views suppressed. To make matters worse, those who remain have their views overstated by several other distortions. Equation of consensus on some climate impact with consensus on massively negative climate impact, the 97% fallacy. Evaluating the likely climate impacts of rising CO2 levels from a human flourishing perspective requires precision about how significant different positive and negative impacts are expected to be. For example, there is an enormous difference between the prediction that rising CO2 will have some mild warming impact, which could be a combination of positive and negative, and the prediction that rising CO2 will have massively negative climate impacts, such as rapid rises in sea levels. Unfortunately, many of our institutions and designated experts try to drive action against fossil fuels by equating a mostly real consensus on some climate impact with a non-existent consensus on massively negative climate impact. The most prominent form of this device is the widespread, deliberately vague claim that 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is real. The basis of such claims are surveys of the field of climate science, such as looking at a large collection of papers in the field and quantifying how many explicitly or implicitly claim that human beings are having some sort of impact on climate. The key thing to note here is that in no case do these surveys find widespread agreement on massively negative impact. The surveys either agree on some unspecified impact, or at most, attribute rising CO2 levels so far as the main cause, over 50%, of the mild 1 degree Celsius warming we have experienced to date. But when the surveys are reported and cited, they are used to claim that 97% of climate scientists agree that fossil fuels will have a massively negative climate impact. Consider the use of the 97% refrain by current climate envoy and former Secretary of State John Kerry in a landmark speech discouraging the people of Indonesia from using fossil fuels, even though they have experienced a major increase in prosperity driven by increasing use of fossil fuels. The science of climate change is leaping out at us like a scene from a 3D movie. It's warning us. It's compelling us to act. And let there be no doubt in anybody's mind that the science is absolutely certain. It's something that we understand with absolute assurance of the veracity of that science. Well, 97% of climate scientists have confirmed that climate change is happening and that human activity is responsible. These scientists agree on the causes of these changes, and they agree on the potential effects. They agree that if we continue to go down the same path that we are going down today, the world as we know it will change, and it will change dramatically for the worse. Note how Kerry goes from 97% of climate scientists have confirmed that climate change is happening and that human activity is responsible, to they agree that if we continue to go down the same path that we are going down today, the world as we know it will change, and it will change dramatically for the worse. Kerry is pulling a bait and switch. Using agreement about some climate impact from rising CO2 levels to gain false authority for his claim of massively negative climate impact from rising CO2 levels. And on top of that, false authority for the anti-fossil fuel policies he wants to pass at home and abroad, which 97% of climate scientists certainly never endorsed. While it is beyond the scope of this book, there are numerous other misrepresentations involved in claims about 97% of climate scientists. Claims that have led many scientists lumped into the 97% category to publicly reject their classification. Equating consensus on some climate impact with consensus on massively negative climate impact is an egregious form of deliberate overstatement. It gives us a totally overstated negative impression about what most climate scientists actually think. It is yet another reason why our climate knowledge system, by its nature, overstates the negative climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. Deliberately overstated report summaries. Another clearly documented example of deliberate overstatement by our knowledge system is the practice of deliberately overstating the negative findings of climate impact synthesis reports via deliberately overstated summaries. The most important example of this is the summary for policymakers of the lengthy assessment reports by the IPCC. As I have said, I think the IPCC is a fundamentally biased organization that is systematically committed to catastrophizing fossil fuels, ignoring the benefits of fossil fuels, and wildly overstating the negative side effects. Some of this catastrophizing exists at the research phase, such as the benefit denial and The Punishment of Climate Catastrophe Skeptics that I documented earlier, and much of it exists at the synthesis phase, when its reports totally ignore the benefits, including climate mastery benefits, of fossil fuels. Further catastrophizing occurs in disseminating the findings of the reports to the general public, which is done in a manner that wildly distorts what even the biased reports say. One of the key mechanisms of distortion is the IPCC's Summary for Policymakers, which is used to identify takeaways from the multi-thousand-page reports that almost no one reads. Numerous participants in the assessment reports have complained over the years that these summaries are wild overstatements of the report's negative conclusions. One such person is the prominent climate economist Richard Toll, whose saga with the IPCC has been thoroughly examined by energy and environment expert Michael Schellenberger. Toll, Schellenberger explains, was charged with drafting a summary for policymakers. The summary initially emphasized the need for economic development in poor countries, but this was nixed because of European nations and more broadly the IPCC's focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Toll said that the primary message of an earlier draft of the summary was, many of the more worrying impacts of climate change are really symptoms of mismanagement and underdevelopment. But representatives from European nations wanted the report's focus to be on emissions reductions, not economic development. IPCC is partly a scientific organization and partly a political organization, Toll explained. As a political organization, its job is to justify greenhouse gas emission reduction. The summary was created by a mixture of scholars and non-scholars. The summary was written during a week-long meeting in Yokohama, Japan. Some of these delegates are scholars, others are not, Toll explained. The Irish delegate, for example, thinks that unmitigated climate change would put us on a highway to hell, referring, I believe, to an AC/DC song rather than a learned paper. The final product was one that Toll found to be completely overstated, leading to his resignation. 2 years later, despite Toll's protests, the IPCC approved a summary for policymakers that was far more apocalyptic than the science warranted. The IPCC shifted from not without risk but manageable to we're all gonna die, explained Toll. It was a shift, he said, from what I think is a relatively accurate assessment of recent developments in literature to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Pestilence, death, famine, and war were all there. In response to the IPCC's decision to let the exaggerators write the summary for policymakers, Toll resigned. I simply thought it was incredible, he said. I told Chris Field, the chairman, about this, and I quietly withdrew. When our climate knowledge system summarizes the already biased syntheses of already biased research to become even more biased, it should lose all credibility. Deliberate overstatement by designated experts for effect. The final deliberate overstatement practice I want to cover is deliberate overstatement by specialists, including scientists, for effect. In 1996, Stanford climate scientist Stephen Schneider wrote an influential paper about the ethics of exaggerating the evidence for catastrophic climate change, including the following passage. On the one hand, as scientists, we are ethically bound to the scientific method, in effect promising to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but, which means that we must include all the doubts, the caveats, the ifs, ands, and buts. On the other hand, we are not just scientists, but human beings as well. And like most people, we'd like to see the world a better place, which in this context translates into our working to reduce the risk of potentially disastrous climate change. To do that, we need to get some broad-based support to capture the public's imagination. That, of course, entails getting loads of media coverage. So, we have to offer up scary scenarios, make simplified dramatic statements, and make little mention of any doubts we might have. This double ethical bind we frequently find ourselves in cannot be solved by any formula. Each of us has to decide what the right balance is between being effective and being honest. I hope that means being both. I disagree entirely that scientists need to decide what the right balance is between being effective and being honest, with effectiveness including simplified dramatic statements and little mention of any doubts we might have. What Schneider is advocating as effectiveness is scientists deliberately overstating what they believe to be true, which means deliberately misleading the public toward decisions that will lead to improper, deadly restrictions on fossil fuels. But for Schneider and others on the anti-impact framework, there is no such phenomenon as improper restrictions on fossil fuels because they deny the positive value of fossil fuels. If there is no positive value of fossil fuels, why not overstate negatives and get people to do the right thing? It's worth it to breach professional ethics if you're saving the planet, that is, saving the planet from what you regard as the evil of fossil fuels' impact. This is the attitude of Paul Ehrlich, who writes, "Scientists need to be direct and succinct when dealing with the electronic media. One could talk for hours about the uncertainties associated with global warming, but a statement like pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere could lead to large-scale food shortages is entirely accurate scientifically and will catch the public's attention." Is such a statement entirely accurate scientifically? What about the fact that were it not for the fuels that necessarily emit greenhouse gases, and were it not for the fact that Ehrlich's proposals to eliminate them were not followed, millions or even billions would have died of starvation? All of these forms of deliberate overstatement by the mainstream climate knowledge system raise the question, why isn't there a widespread revolt among the many researchers who know that the mainstream climate knowledge system is deliberately overstating the negative impacts of rising CO2 levels? Two related reasons: the anti-impact framework and the ignorance about energy's value that the anti-impact framework has led to. Most scientists have absorbed the anti-impact framework to a significant degree, so it seems proper to have an overriding moral focus on reducing human impact on climate, without much thought about what harm that does to human flourishing. And because the anti-impact framework leads to a knowledge system that keeps everyone ignorant of the benefits of fossil fuels, including their climate mastery benefits, restricting or eliminating fossil fuel use seems like a costless goal. Thus, certain designated experts' deliberate overstatement for effect is not viewed as deadly dishonesty that could disempower billions. It is viewed as ethically distasteful overstatement with the noble goal of getting rid of CO2 emissions. Ditto for deliberately overstated report summaries or 97% of climate scientists agree claims. If someone is overstating reality to do the right thing, why risk your status to challenge them? Most researchers cannot think of a reason to do so. But I hope that those who read this book now realize there is an urgent life-or-death reason to do so, because the benefits of fossil fuels are fundamental to the livability of our planet. The four forms of deliberate distortion, plus CO2 benefit denial, plus climate mastery denial, mean that our climate knowledge system cannot be trusted. There are not just a few problems, there is systemic climate distortion. This has two implications. The first is that there is every reason to suspect that claims of climate catastrophe, let alone apocalypse, are not scientific, but rather framework-driven catastrophizing, falsely predicting that a side effect will be catastrophic by wildly overstating its negativity and by ignoring our ability to master it. The second is that if we want to have a real understanding of the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels, especially whether there are likely to be potentially catastrophic impacts, we must reject the existing channels of the mainstream climate knowledge system and find genuine sources of expert knowledge that are minimally distorted by the anti-impact framework. How do we do this? Finding the full range of minimally distorted expert assessments. In my view, the best way to find genuine sources of expert climate knowledge, minimally distorted by the anti-impact framework, is to seek out the mainstream and non-mainstream expert sources that are under the least pressure to deliberately distort science to achieve anti-fossil fuel goals. One less distorted mainstream source is certain portions of the IPCC assessment reports. I say certain portions because the overall approach of those reports, let alone the deliberately dishonest summaries, is driven by the anti-impact framework. However, the sections of IPCC reports that deal with more delimited scientific questions, particularly where there is no prediction involved, such as the trend of precipitation in one area or another over a certain time period, are much more objective than the public summaries of them. And they have the benefit of referencing a wide range of papers and scholars from different subspecializations of climate science. Another valuable source of less distorted mainstream climate expertise is textbooks, under which I include literal textbooks as well as other non-advocacy materials. While the thinking and communication of authors are very likely to be somewhat distorted by the anti-impact framework, the authors are attempting to explain issues with precision, including to explain what degrees of confidence there are in various claims. Together, selections from IPCC reports and textbooks give, I believe, a relatively realistic sense of what those in mainstream research institutions think. Certainly an incomparably better sense than mainstream media institutions or IPCC summaries for policymakers. What about the genuine expert views that have been excluded from the mainstream knowledge system? Understanding these requires a different, complementary approach. Reading the work of highly trained climate scientists who are considered outsiders or skeptics. I stress highly trained because there is a real danger when reading challenges to the mainstream that one will be taken in by skeptics who have a superficial knowledge of the field. One check against this is to read challenges to catastrophism from those who are or have in the past been acknowledged as highly knowledgeable about climate science. For example, the aforementioned Richard Lindzen, Judith Curry, and Patrick Michaels fall into this category. Reading the less distorted mainstream materials, plus the most informed challenges to the mainstream, gives us the range of minimally distorted positions that exist on the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels, something the mainstream climate knowledge system fails to do. An enormous aid to understanding the range of positions, as well as to assessing which ones are most likely to be right, is exposing ourselves to as much debate as possible among the different positions. Witnessing debate among knowledgeable specialists is one of the most powerful tools that outsiders to a field have to evaluate the comparative merits of positions within that field. One benefit of debate is that the more specialists explain their disagreements with one another, the easier it is to identify areas of general agreement, such as the point that the greenhouse effect of CO2, as I will explain in the next chapter, is a diminishing, not accelerating effect that becomes weaker for every additional molecule of CO2. A second benefit of debate is that the more specialists explain their disagreements with one another, the more pieces of context emerge that might not emerge from just one perspective. For example, reading arguments from the critics of climate models exposed me to some of the limitations of those models, while reading arguments from the proponents of those models exposed me to arguments for their efficacy that many critics don't engage. A third benefit of debate is that the more specialists explain their disagreements with one another, the easier it is to see differences in the quality of arguments, including where the quality is affected by different operating frameworks. While our knowledge system systematically discourages debate by punishing skeptics, it does not totally stop it. Occasionally, there are actual debates between significantly different positions, which reveal a lot. Often these are available on YouTube. I find these valuable to watch to get a sense of how the different positions actually hold up under pressure. Beyond literal debates, there are several forms of quasi-debate that are valuable to witness. One form of quasi-debate is blogging. Often, what happens is that a prominent non-catastrophist, such as Judith Curry, will post something. Her blog is climate, etc. And if it becomes widely read enough, it may elicit a response from the borderline catastrophist blog, Real Climate. Another form of quasi-debate is competing critical articles from different positions about other positions. For example, Real Climate will post criticisms of skeptic views, and What's Up With That will post criticisms of catastrophist views. Once we have the range of minimally distorted expert positions, including debates among the positions where possible, we have the raw material to come to an informed conclusion about the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels. The next step is to assess the raw material as accurately as possible to get the best sense of the truth. Questions and standards for assessing climate claims. Finding the range of minimally distorted expert positions is key to answering the question, what are the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system from a human flourishing perspective? But it is not enough. Knowing the range of views is not the same as knowing the likely impacts, because we need some way of knowing which views are likely to be right and which are likely to be significant distortions of reality. To identify which views are most likely to be right, we need standards for assessing competing climate claims. The standards of assessment that I use fall into two related categories: standards of proper framework and standards of objective explanation. I'll start with standards of proper framework. As we have seen again and again, the anti-impact framework is a fundamental distorting force when it comes to evaluations and to predictions about the future, the likely climate impacts of rising CO2 levels being such a prediction. So it is highly instructive to know when a given climate-predicting thinker or resource is on the anti-impact framework. One standard for validating or invalidating someone's framework is their goal or standard of evaluation. We have seen that if an expert is on the standard of eliminating human impact, they will regard all human impact on climate as bad, even if it is neutral or positive for human beings. They will also be inclined to deliberately overstate, for effect, the anti-human impacts of rising CO2 levels. To the extent someone operates on the goal of eliminating human impact, I regard their scientific claims as very likely distorted and look for others who are not operating on the anti-impact framework. Here are some questions I find helpful in determining whether someone is operating on the goal of eliminating human impact. Do they focus on the human consequences of rising CO2 levels, or do they focus on very remote effects on the rest of nature? Do they discuss both potential negative and positive effects of rising CO2 levels, or just negative? Are they concerned about the need for billions more people to have affordable, reliable energy, or are they indifferent to that need? Do they treat reduction of CO2 as a policy with very real negatives, even if worth it, or do they treat it as a no-brainer? Do they recognize the amazingly positive overall state of today's world, including our unprecedented safety from climate, or do they treat one or both as destroyed? An example of someone revealing himself as operating on a pro-human goal and standard is the aforementioned Freeman Dyson saying, "I feel very strongly that China and India getting rich is the most important thing that's going on in the world at present. That's a real revolution, that the center of gravity of the whole population of the world would be middle class, and that's a wonderful thing to happen." By contrast, those who treat today's world as bad reveal themselves to not be on a pro-human standard. The second standard for validating framework is assumptions about the relationship between human beings and the rest of nature. We have seen that if an expert is on the delicate nurturer assumption, including the parasite polluter view of humans, they will expect far more significant and negative consequences of a given impact than is actually warranted. We saw this in all the wildly overstated side effect predictions about fossil fuels going back 50 years, from resource depletion to pollution to global cooling to global warming. To the extent someone is on the delicate nurturer assumption, they are virtually guaranteed to overpredict negative climate impacts. So any sign of that is a red flag. Here are some questions I find helpful in determining whether someone is on the delicate nurturer assumption, including the parasite polluter assumption. Do they talk about unimpacted parts of nature as delicate or fragile or stable? Do they glorify the climate absent human impact? Do they treat human beings as inherently short-sighted and inevitably self-destructive? Do they ignore human beings' positive environmental impacts? One giveaway of both elements of the anti-impact framework is any kind of claim about how the planet has way too many people. For example, designated expert Michael Mann has written, "We probably already exceed the planet's carrying capacity by a factor of 8. This kind of statement reveals deep saturation in the delicate nurture assumption, as well as a callous disregard for the value of human life. To casually talk about billions of people as if their lives were a bad thing is not something someone on the human flourishing framework would do. In addition to applying standards for validating framework when considering different climate claims, I also apply standards of objective explanation. By objective explanation, I mean an explanation that gives the reader or listener sufficient evidence to agree with the expert's conclusion. In my experience, objective explanations of climate claims are rare, in large part because the catastrophist position has tried to suppress questions and debate in favor of submission to alleged authority. When we find sources that engage in objective explanation, we have much more reason to think they are right, and because we have an explanation, it is much easier to assess whether they are right. Here are four standards of objective explanation I use when validating climate claims. 1. They give clear explanations of the evidence for their views rather than just invoking authority. I take seriously only sources that clearly explain what their evidence is. If they pronounce authoritative claims without evidence, I suspect their goal is something other than generating an understanding of the truth. 2. They are precise, not sloppy, with terminology, magnitudes, and probabilities. Understanding the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels requires precise terminology, magnitudes, and probabilities. When specialists use vague, sloppy language like climate change is real, I do not trust them. If they discuss man-made climate change or anthropogenic climate change and specific impacts on temperature and other aspects of climate and explain their degree of confidence, they are much more credible. 3. They distinguish degrees of known and unknown in their field and for themselves personally. One giveaway of a careful thinker is that they are clear with themselves and with others about what they know with confidence, what claims they have some evidence for but not conclusive evidence for, and where they are ignorant. 2 questions I find helpful in this connection to ask about specialists' claims are, do they discuss the different amounts of evidence for different claims, or do they treat all claims on their side as virtually certain? We see the latter when all claims about climate, from CO2 causes some warming impact to we face an existential threat, are viewed as undeniable parts of proven climate science. Do they acknowledge the limits of their own knowledge, or do they opine with equal confidence on all issues. We see the latter when certain climate scientists claim with confidence that solar and wind can do everything fossil fuels can do. 4. They legitimately engage and address competing viewpoints without evading, demonizing, or strawmanning them. Because questions and debate reveal so much about the relative strengths of different positions, it is crucial to observe whether specialists can answer critical questions and counter other arguments in a clear, persuasive way. Some questions I find helpful to ask about specialists are: do they acknowledge the range of intelligent people who disagree with them, or do they write off everyone who disagrees with them as immoral or stupid? Do they engage criticisms politely and effectively, or do they engage primarily with attacks on their critics' motives and intelligence? Do they represent dissenting views accurately, or do they smear them? Are they willing to debate genuinely thoughtful, knowledgeable people who disagree with them, or do they like to say, the debate is over? Using the preceding standards of framework and of objective explanation has helped me understand what, among experts who are not obviously distorted by the anti-impact framework, is the range of agreement and disagreement. Above all, it has enabled me to develop an extremely strong conviction on the question of whether there is anything truly catastrophic, let alone apocalyptic, about fossil fuel side effect of rising CO2 levels when we factor in the benefit of climate mastery. My conclusion is that there is not at all. All claims of catastrophe and apocalypse are based on a combination of the climate mastery denial and climate impact distortion that pervade our anti-impact knowledge system. When we look at the full context, we find that climate apocalypse is impossible, catastrophe is inconceivable, and expanding fossil fuel use, a fossil future, is the only moral path forward.